and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Friday's announcement, exactly 8 years after Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, that the DOJ was suing Georgia for violating the Voting Rights Act, and that they would be looking into voter suppression of minorities in other states, as well as investigating threats against poll workers across the country. Joining us to assess what can be done to protect the votes of all Americans in forthcoming elections, now that the For the People Act is stalled in the Senate due to a red wall of Republican resistance, is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who is now a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast. We'll discuss how the Supreme Court could rule next week on Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to weaken it further, although the DOJ could ask the courts to invoke a rarely used part of the act, which would place Georgia under federal supervision. Then we will look into a draft law intended to prosecute offenses against the environment, with international legal experts having drawn up an historic definition of ecocide, which could be taken up by the International Criminal Court to prosecute politicians and corporations for, quote, unlawful and wanton acts committed with knowledge that there is a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts. Kate McIntosh, the Executive Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at the UCLA School of Law and Deputy Chair of the Stop Ecocide Foundation and a member of the independent panel of experts for the legal definition of ecocide, joins us. Then finally, with many analysts concerned that the Biden bipartisan deal with Republican senators on infrastructure is too focused on repairing the deferred needs of the past in fixing roads and bridges, etc., as opposed to investing in the critically needed infrastructure of the future, vital to reducing global warming, if indeed we are to have a future as we know it on this planet. Joining us to discuss his work on how the business community and corporate America is failing us even more than our government in not investing in the future is William Lozonik, a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts and president of the Academic Industry Research Network, who has written several papers for the Institute of New Economic Thinking and is the co-author of Predatory Value Extraction, How the Looting of the Business Corporation Became the U.S. Norm and How Sustainable Prosperity Can Be Restored. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is Merrick Garland Can't Avoid Investigating Trump-Era Abuses Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, thanks, Harry. And on Friday, the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, announced that the Justice Department is suing the state of Georgia for its voter suppression laws. Quoting the Attorney General, "This lawsuit is the first step of many we are taking to ensure that all eligible voters can cast a vote and that all lawful votes are counted and that every voter has access to accurate information." Now, this took place on Friday, which is exactly to the day, 8 years after the Chief Justice John Roberts gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So, a coincidence?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's a coincidence in timing with one little asterisk, which I'll get to in a moment. But as you say, the Department of Justice used to have this very robust and important tool that Congress had continually renewed since it was originally passed in the 60s that required states with a history of discrimination to get so-called pre-clearance when they wanted to do the kinds of changes that the Georgia law does. And the Georgia law does a lot of worrisome changes that might well depress minority voting. It really substantially limits absentee balloting. It puts a lot of power in the state. It has this notorious provision that could make it a crime to give some water and food to people standing in long lines. The way in which I think it's not a coincidence is that we are in June, again, 8 years later, as the Shelby County decision was. And this June, the Supreme Court has two cases, actually, that will probably be announced next week. And they are under the remaining provision, Section 2, that in the wake of the gutting, as you aptly put it, of Section 5, or the most powerful part of the Voting Rights Act by the Chief Justice 8 years ago, is the remaining kind of moderately effective tool of the department. It's challenging, and maybe we'll get into why. But I think they wanted, in fact, to get off the dime and launch this suit before the Supreme Court decides next week. It doesn't mean, of course, that the court's ruling won't hold. If they say Section 2 means something very different, making the suit untenable, it remains untenable. But I think it will be at least have established that the department was trying to go in and do the right thing under Section 2 as we now understand it.
But is this Justice Department effort initiated by the Attorney General on Friday with Christian Clark and Vinita Gupta standing beside him, he's doubling the number of people in the Civil Rights Division. But is he anticipating what would happen or what might happen next week if the Supreme Court guts Section 2?
Well, in a sense, though, again, as you say, you know, Garland, and this is kind of what my article was about, had been largely passive, largely thinking I'll just move forward. And he now finds himself being increasingly responsive to Republican or Trumpian efforts. And this is a significant way. Doubling is a very unusual increase in staff, for example. But it's not as if there's anything they can do to prevent the court from changing the meaning of Section 2, but it will at least be clear their resolve to bring it, and it will put the court in a somewhat embarrassing position should the department be coming in now and saying under the law, this is a violation. And now Supreme Court pulls the rug out from under them. So I think in that sense, it was purposeful. And as you say, that kind of phalanx of the three women, Lisa Monaco, Vinita Gupta, and Kristen Clark, and we could add Pam Carlin, who's Kristen Clark's chief deputy and one of the architects in this area. It was a show of force as it now exists in the Department of Justice and a promise of more muscle flexing to come. And I think they see it as, you know, rightfully in terms of an overall political struggle. Why Georgia, Arizona, Texas, and not the Deep South, for example? And I think it's part of a national Republican thought through process. These are the very states that are at the knife's edge of blue and red, and where marginal depressions in the turnout could help them return to power or majority status in the Senate in 2022. So it really is, you know, apart from It's not quite the kind of Ku Klux Klan invidious racism of the 60s, say, nor does it need to be under the law, but it is a concerted campaign to suppress the vote and suppress votes of minorities, black and brown people, because the Republicans understand that they are more likely to be for Democrats, and they need, given their numbers, their minority numbers in the country, they need to do some suppression in order to eke out a possible return to electoral dominance.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Litman. He's a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, and he's a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and he's also the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is Merrick Garland Can't Avoid Investigating Trump-Era Abuses Now. Well, of course, at the time, 8 years ago from Friday, when Chief Justice Roberts announced the gutting of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, he said our country has changed. Well,
right.
Lately it is changing for the worse, not for the better. And as you point out, this is happening right across the country. But there is a three-tiered attack strategy on the part of the Republicans. The first is gerrymandering and voter suppression, meaning that they could win before one vote is cast. And then once the votes are cast through partisan Republican legislatures, they get to count the votes and certify the votes. And then there's the third aspect of it, which is the intimidation of poll workers, neutral people that have been working the polls forever, and particularly in the last election, which was considered the cleanest and most effective and the highest turnout in American history. Even the Attorney General, William Barr, who was clearly pro-Trump, said it was an election without any fraud or faults. And yet that has become the excuse under Trump of stop the steal. So one of the aspects of what was announced on Friday by Attorney General Garland is the extent to which the Justice Department is concerned about attacks on election workers. So what's going to be done in that case?
They are setting up a actual task force, and that sounds like a bureaucratic move, but it isn't in the part where it comes from the Department of Justice. The Deputy Attorney General has sent a memo to the field, and everyone is geared up. I think this is one aspect where the Republicans, you know, led with their chin. The notion of badgering church workers who are giving some food and water to people, usually minorities, who have to wait in scandalously long lines while people in white neighborhoods cruise through. That's, you know, really seems like completely unjust bullying. And the department is now geared up to and commanded to be on the lookout for it. So I think in individual precincts where you have, you know, tough guys trying to intimidate, especially Democratic either workers or just citizens who are lawfully giving food or otherwise, you know, comfort to people who spend hours in line to exercise the right to vote, the Department of Justice will stand at the ready to really lower the boom. And my best guess is that alone will make it effective, and we won't see very much of the kind of, you know, brash aggression against poll workers that is basically permitted in the Georgia law. That's part of what a couple of these laws are doing. They're, you know, actually trying to, under the thinnest guise of some kind of voter integrity, to let Republican partisan folks badger and deter Democratic voters.
Well, I think what Merrick Garland was also referring to is that the fact that a recent poll of election workers said that half of them feel threatened.
And yeah,
they're quitting in droves. And what's happening is when they quit, these partisan Republicans, like the insane QAnon people that are conducting this bogus audit in Arizona, are then applying to become election workers and take over.
Yes.
It's a very aggressive and pernicious program that the Republicans are launching.
You know, I think that's right. And as I say, I think this one is a mistake on their part. They try in general, I think not very persuasively, but to say it's all about voter integrity. And there are aspects of it, I think, that are hard for Democrats to really combat, you know, certain, you know, voter ID and the like. But this just seems like flat out, you know, bullying and leveraging of power. It's a sort of softer version of the nastiest aspects of the 1960s, where Department of Justice people had to go down to Alabama and escort, you know, little black boys and girls to school. It's that kind of, you know, need for a national presence to actually keep the you know, local state officials from the nastiest sort of abridgment of rights. And I think, as I say, it will happen. And also, as I say, that it's it was sort of a political misstep for them to include this kind of stuff.
So given that the For the People Act was filibustered to death in the Senate, this is obviously incredibly important what the Justice Department can do. And I understand that their tactic to get around the possibility of an adverse ruling next week on Section 2, along with the 8 years ago ruling on Section 5, gutting that, is that they're making the argument that instead of relying on the results test in terms of Georgia, they are focusing on the intent to discriminate. However, an important part of what they've done in Georgia, and the most troubling provision in this new law, allows Republican officials to take over local election boards, and that they will then have the power to close polling places and disqualify voters. That's not even being addressed, my understanding is.
Yeah, I think you're, well, you mean by the DOJ, perhaps.
By the DOJ, right.
But that is a really big part of the law that people have not focused on. They are, in fact, you know, it's at that central level, Raffensperger, the governor, et cetera, that Georgia has the most sort of crass and partisan kind of muscle. And yes, they are making them the bosses in charge who can come in anytime. Not a lot really to be done about it in general. With no Voting Rights Act, with no For the People Act, and with no Section 5, the tools are limited. And you're right that what they have to do under Section 2 is not just a results test. You know, before, when there were places with history of discrimination like Georgia, they would have to show that the results would not be biased in terms of against minorities. Now they have to show a kind of intent, and it's always very hard to do that. You know, essentially, the other side will stand up and say with great umbrage, what do you mean we're racist? But an important point here is they don't have to show the sort of invidious racism that we often think of in the context of the civil rights laws. They don't have to show some kind of inbred hostility toward African Americans. What they have to show is a purpose to do what? To make it harder for African Americans to vote simply because they more likely vote Democrat, and that just has a political purpose. And there is a lot of evidence in the record that that's exactly what was going on, not to mention that the reason proffered, the voter integrity, has been, you know, a tissue thin pretext. It's always a tough road to hoe to basically be, you know, accusing people of having impure motives. But again, the motives are basically just straightforwardly political. We're not calling you, you know, neo Ku Klux Klanners. We're saying you're very strategically wanting to make it harder for brown and black voters because they're less likely to vote for you. And there are, you know, points in the record they can proffer, but on the other hand, not an easy showing. You can see it going either way.
And just to be a little more depressing here, Harry, the case that the DOJ are bringing against Georgia, it's the judge that's been assigned to the case is a judge, J.P. Bulley, who is a Trump judge. So
Although let me add, you know, even a broken clock works right twice a day. As best I can tell, I went to school on him a little yesterday. He doesn't seem to be the Trumpiest of the Trumpies. He's got a military background, was generally considered, you know, at least not overly ideological. I don't think he's going to, as Trump judges go, he's not a terrible draw, let me put it that way.
Well, just to close on the importance of that voting has consequences, particularly when it comes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court just issued a ruling 5-4 on a case called TransUnion versus Rodriguez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was a case in which a company that issues credit reports, TransUnion, erroneously damaged the credit ratings of 6,000 of their customers by categorizing them as criminals. And in this ruling, Kavanaugh's majority opinion means that federal judges, not the people's representatives in the Congress, get to decide which rights may be vindicated in the federal judiciary. And by extension, it means that federal judges get to decide what counts as concrete harm. This was such an egregious ruling that Clarence Thomas joined with the liberals. He was outraged by it. How does it strike you?
You know, he always has pockets, kind of interesting pockets of outrage. You know, he was also on the side of saying that there wasn't standing to bring the religious case. Look, I basically feel this, and I think is my next article, that the surmises of a moderate center-right court are way overstated, and we have a monolithic conservative court emerging. And that means a lot of decisions that I think are out of step. I take your point on this one. I think there have been a couple other ones, including this week's takings clause argument, in which a brief entry onto the land of a farm owner for unions was judged a physical taking, notwithstanding that regulators all over the country have quick temporary access to different places. That I think, you know, really that's one of the sort of hobby horses of the right, the takings clause. And I think in general, even the so-called, you know, moderate opinions that have emerged in the last couple weeks when all the action happens have been ones that don't foreclose the more conservative results coming up. And then, of course, we have looming like a freight train, the Mississippi abortion case, and the like. So I, for one, am not reassured the way some, I think, commentators are, that, you know, maybe the court is tacking a little bit center, and Kavanaugh is throwing in with Roberts, etc. I think these five will march strongly in the cases that most matter to them, and those will be the cases that I think most cut against the grain of the rights that American people have come to enjoy in previous generations of the court.
Well, Harold Lipman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be with you.
Well, thanks, Harry. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Lipman, who's a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is Merrick Garland Can't Avoid Investigating Trump-Era Abuses Now. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a draft law intended to prosecute offenses against the environment, with international legal experts having drawn up an historic definition of ecocide, which could be taken up by the International Criminal Court to prosecute politicians and corporations.
You don't need to change the futures with us. Don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your vote.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kate McIntosh, who's Executive Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at the UCLA School of Law. She was an administrator responsible as Deputy Registrar for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia's court operations. And previously, she was a legal advisor to Doctors Without Borders and was part of a post-conflict human rights field operations in Bosnia as well as Rwanda. She is the deputy chair of the Stop Ecocide Foundation and a member of the independent expert panel for the legal definition of ecocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate McIntosh.
Hi, Ian. Happy to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the term for genocide was coined in 1944 by a Polish jurist, and I believe it was what in 1972 that the former Prime Minister of Sweden, Olof Palme, he used the term or coined the term of ecocide at a UN conference on the human environment. But since then, what's happened to it? And it appears that you have picked it up and are now trying to get it accepted as a definition in law.
Yeah, exactly that. So the concept of ecocide, as you said, first emerged in the early 70s as a reaction to the kind of devastation that was seen in Vietnam through the use of Agent Orange and so on. And it developed as an idea that a couple of academics tossed around, and it was broadened to include not just environmental damage during warfare, but also in peacetime, and to start to look towards the kind of issues that are at the forefront of our minds today, like industrial pollution and so on. But in terms of actual law, it didn't make any progress. There were a couple of attempts. Actually, an earlier version of what became the statute of the International Criminal Court did include a suggestion, a suggested crime of committing severe damage to the environment as an international crime, which is very much what we're looking at today. But that didn't make it through to the final draft. So we have drawn upon these existing threads to propose a crime that's written in the language of today's international criminal law. And we feel that now's a moment that this might actually become possible as we're all becoming more aware of the impending climate crisis.
And in terms of the statute that you're proposing for ecocide, for the purpose of this statute, ecocide means unlawful or wanton acts committed with knowledge that there is a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts. So given that we have a window to act on climate change before we reach the point of no return, and that number keeps unfortunately being brought forward, I don't know what the latest number is. This most recent UN climate report is quite alarming, and it suggests that we have less time than we thought we had. So we have roughly 10 years to deal with climate change and reduce CO2 by an extraordinary factor and make massive changes. And we've just seen the attempt by the President and the Senate to come up with an infrastructure package that largely doesn't address the challenges of the future and, in fact, mostly spends money on repair jobs of the past that have been languishing. So what's your sense of how much time we have before the point of no return and, therefore, the need to act to save this planet is incredibly dire?
Well, that's the urgency that's driven this. So the idea of what we're trying to do is we're trying to amplify that sense of urgency in this by using a new language or a new symbol. So the point of the crime is to say, wake up, everybody. Severe, and widespread or long-term damage to the environment is actually as serious as genocide. It's as serious as crimes against humanity. It's that kind of existential threat. It is really... it's on the same level as other international crimes, which, as you know, means crimes that the global community has decided are unacceptable behaviour and that they can be punished at a global level and in different countries, no matter where they occur. So there's a symbolic value to this crime of ecocide. It's really raising awareness about the gravity of what we're doing to our natural environment. So that's maybe the first point. I think if it were accepted as a crime on that level, it would send a really clear message, like, okay, we've understood it's that serious. And the other important thing about an international crime is an international crime is a crime against all of us. So I think destroying the environment is a clear candidate for that. And it doesn't matter where it's committed. You know, it can be prosecuted in theory. It can be prosecuted anywhere in the same way that, you know, Nazi collaborators have been prosecuted in different countries around the world since the Second World War. So it's this idea of a universal jurisdiction because it's a crime against everyone. So I think that sends a really strong message. Obviously, in terms of actual prosecution, I mean, we all know that criminal law doesn't stop crime. But I do think that there is a chance that having an international crime of ecocide will have a substantial effect on the behaviour, for example, of corporations. And of course, that's what we're looking at as major contributors to climate change. Because it's our hope that a CEO of a large corporation is more susceptible to bad PR than the leader of an, you know, armed group who's potentially committing war crimes or genocide. So our hope is, and our calculation is, that if this is introduced as a crime, it will shift the whole risk assessment of carbon majors and other major polluting industries in terms of what they can do. At the moment, they just bake in, you know, the costs of losing litigation, for example. But this will be very different. This will be the actual people responsible at the top. We're talking the CEOs, the leaders of the organization, potentially government officials who are responsible for permitting this kind of action. They will be personally criminally responsible. And I think that has the potential to really shift thinking and practice, you know, in a way which I hope will be fast enough to meet the challenges you described.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate McIntosh, who's the Executive Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at the UCLA School of Law. She was an administrator responsible as Deputy Registrar for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia's court operations, and previously was a legal advisor to Doctors Without Borders and was part of a post-conflict human rights field operations in Bosnia as well as Rwanda. And she's the deputy chair of the Stop Ecocide Foundation and a member of the independent expert panel for the legal definition of ecocide. So, for example, the lungs of the earth, which is what the Brazil rainforests are referred to, they soak up CO2, which is the problem with global warming, is too much CO2, and there are very few ways to deal with it. Sequestering it hasn't really worked. And the only way that nature has provided us with dealing with CO2 is through photosynthesis, through trees and rainforests, etc. So as the Brazil rainforests are being cut down at an extraordinary rate under President Bolsonaro, who is a kind of global warming denier and, in fact, is contemptuous towards environmental programs, would he be liable under this new law?
Potentially. What we hope we've done is create a credible criminal law framework for prosecutors to bring, you know, situations that they think fit that and for judges to interpret it. So it would have to be determined that President Bolsonaro or anybody else had committed acts knowing that there's a substantial likelihood that they would cause severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment. So that would be the equation. So we'd have to look at the deforestation, we'd have to look at which acts, and acts include emissions, which acts were committed that led to this, you know, which acts could be attributed to him, and whether it could be said that he knew there was a substantial likelihood, so not certainty, but substantial likelihood. And in the area of climate change, that's very important, because although the science is pretty clear, you know, you can't say it's a kind of 99% clarity that this act leads to that. But if there's a substantial likelihood, which is a reasonable threshold in criminal law, of causing that damage, then that person would be liable. So I would say there's certainly potential for that, yes.
But does it have to be a willful damage to the environment, or is it a question of commission or omission?
No, great question. So we thought about that. Obviously, most of the damage that's being done to the environment is not done in order to damage the environment, right? That's not the motive. That's not the driving force. The damage to the environment is the effect of acts which are committed usually for, you know, reasons of, for profit motive, basically. So we couldn't require an intent to harm the environment, because that would exclude almost all the serious cases that we want to catch with this law. So what we've gone in terms of the mental element with is this idea of knowledge of a substantial likelihood. So it's similar to what's known as a recklessness standard in criminal law. So if you as an individual are aware of this substantial likelihood and you nonetheless carry on, then you would be liable for the crime.
So in terms of homicide, just to get a sort of handle on it for the layperson here, if, for example, you knew somebody was going to die, was diagnosed, and they would certainly die within 10 years if they weren't given a treatment that's available and effective, and somehow you were responsible for denying that person that treatment, could you be held responsible for homicide?
I mean, that depends in which jurisdiction you're talking about, and I'm not an expert on American law, but in general, in any jurisdiction, that would depend on the intention of the person denying it and the reasons for which it was denied, right? So we can all imagine situations in which it was reasonable to deny the treatment. I mean, perhaps it's a public health decision, it's very expensive, and the money was better spent vaccinating thousands of children, you know, this kind of thing. So there could be some reasons why the action was not taken that would be legitimate, right? And the reason I mention that is there is an analogy. We have created an analogy to that in this crime, actually, because we realise that all sorts of activities that are legitimate and even beneficial do cause widespread or long-term damage to the environment. For example, a housing development. Right. That will, I mean, cutting down a whole load of trees, putting foundations into the earth and so on, that could be considered widespread or long term damage to the environment, as could transport links, building a dam. I mean, there may be very good reasons not to build a dam, but it may not rise to the level of ecocide. Right. So environmental law is actually all about balancing social benefits, social and to a lesser extent economic benefits, in terms of the way economic benefits, of course, become social benefits, balancing those with preservation of the environment. And that's in the concept of sustainable development, right? So it's permitted, we permit ourselves to use the environment. We don't have to leave it in a pristine state. But of course, it has to be sustainable. It has to be able to sustain life going forward and not be eradicated in the way we're doing now. So what we've included in this definition is the idea that the damage not only has to be severe and either widespread or long term, but it has to be, there has to be a reckless disregard for damage which would be clearly excessive in relation to the social and economic benefits anticipated. In other words, this action has to be unjustifiable. It has to be reckless. It has to be, has to not have gone through the usual environmental law balancing. Mm-hmm. So if we think back to the Bolsonaro situation, for example, I think that would be quite important, because obviously cultivating the Amazon to a certain degree is perfectly legitimate. What we would have to look at is whether there was just reckless disregard for this damage to the lungs of the planet, as you said, and that it was really not benefiting the local population in any meaningful way or any proportionate way. It was out of all proportion to the kind of benefit that we might expect from a more responsible stewardship of the environment.
Well, just in closing, since we've had this horrible disaster in Florida and a lot of investigation now going on, the extent to which rising sea level and subsidence are a big factor in why this building collapsed and 159 people are still missing. The previous governor of Florida was an active climate change denier. Mm-hmm. In fact, he made it absolutely forbid any state employee for using the word climate change, and he referred to the fact that in Florida, ocean rises at an alarming level and regularly floods during king tides. He referred to that as nuisance flooding or something like some ridiculous euphemism. The current governor, DeSantis, says he's not a global warming denier, but he's not a global warming believer. So if these politicians are in denial about global warming and not doing anything about recognizing what the threats are to these buildings on the coast in Florida from the rising oceans. Is there any liability there under this new ecocide regime?
That's a great question. I mean, whether there would be liability for not acting, you know, not taking action to mitigate the damage, I think that would not be included. It's really about contributing to the damage, so contributing to the sea level rise. So if, I mean, government officials, we mentioned Bolsonaro, but government officials would certainly be in the firing line to the extent that they either introduce or maintain policies which are contributing to severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment. So to the extent that the people you're referring to have done that, then they would fall within the scope of ecocide.
Well, Kate McIntosh, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
You're absolutely welcome, Ian. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Kate McIntosh, who's the Executive Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at the UCLA School of Law. She was an administrator responsible as Deputy Registrar for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia's court operations. And previously, she was a legal advisor to Doctors Without Borders and was part of a post-conflict human rights field operations in Bosnia as well as Rwanda. And she's the deputy chair of the Stop Ecocide Foundation and a member of the independent expert panel for the legal definition of ecocide. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how the business community and corporate America is failing us even more than our government in not investing in the future.
At least it's not the end of the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Lozonik, who's a professor emeritus of economics and a former director of the University of Massachusetts Center for Industrial Competitiveness. He's the president of the Academic Industry Research Network, and his books include Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy, Business Organization and High-Tech Employment in the United States, and Predatory Value Extraction, How the Looting of the Business Corporation Became the U.S. Norm and How Sustainable Prosperity Can Be Restored. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Lozonik.
Good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And a few days ago, William, the president, along with a group of Republicans and Democrats, had announced this bipartisan deal to deal with infrastructure, which most analysts feel is really about fixing up unmet needs of the past, like bridges and roads, etc., and not dealing with the urgent needs of the future, like electrifying the grid with clean energy, electrifying transportation, and dealing with global warming, in order to have a planet that we can live on, as the crisis gives us about 10 years in which to act. So if the government itself is short-sighted and incapable of dealing with the real challenges, my understanding from the work that you've been doing, William, is that American industry and corporate America is equally incapable or unwilling to deal with the future. And so tell us about the work that you've been doing and the findings that you've come up with.
Well, I think the going back in terms of the Biden's conception of what needs to be done, I like it in terms of the extent of the investment in infrastructure that's needed, tying it to what he calls his Families Act, because the economy doesn't run on infrastructure alone; it runs on human capabilities, and that starts with families that are supportive, that have decent childcare, housing, et cetera, and schooling. So I like Biden's whole point of view on this. The compromises that he's making, well, they'll have to live with them for now and see what they can push through later. But that's not my main problem that I've been writing about and writing about for some time, including I know when I was out there in L.A. talking with you, I think it was about 8 years ago. And at that point, I was warning about stock buybacks, which, of course, I've written about. And that's what that book, Predatory Value Extraction, that you mentioned, came out in January 2020, is mainly about the looting of the U.S. business corporation. And if we take one example, very well-known example, I think when I talked to you last time, Apple might have just started doing some stock buybacks, but in since 2013, they've done $421 billion in buybacks, about $106 billion in dividends. And basically, they have been pissing their money away, to put it crudely, on just getting people to sell their shares, getting their stock price up. And that has huge consequences. Now, one of the consequences that I've been looking at, and I look at different companies, is part of this infrastructure bill, and part I think that will be is being supported by the Republicans, is the support of the semiconductor industry. Now, about $50 billion. Now, the semiconductor industry in the United States has fallen behind, particularly there's been a lot of focus on Intel, which has fallen behind TSMC and Samsung in 7 and 5 nanometer process, the most advanced process in semiconductors. Well, the problem is that I have is that Intel has over the last 3 years, 2018, 2020, spent about $14 billion a year on stock buybacks. Now, it's also spent roughly equivalent amount on capital expenditures, an additional amount of several billions a year on R&D. But Intel should not have been spending that money just trying to boost its stock price by getting people to manipulating it up to get people to sell their shares. They should have been doubling down in terms of investment in advanced semiconductor capability. And I have a paper come out soon, actually already submitted it as a comment to one of the agencies that was getting public comments on the infrastructure bill, on the supply chain part of it. Its competitors, Samsung and TSMC, don't do that, or at least Samsung does to a more limited extent, mainly because of raids on it by U.S. predators, particularly Elliott Management, but not to the same extent. And Samsung pays hardly any dividends out. TSMC pays more, but these companies are spending $28, $30 billion a year now investing in advanced semiconductor capability, and Intel's fallen behind and probably irreversibly fallen behind. Now, it's interesting because that's where Apple comes in, because people would say, well, what should Apple have done with that $421 billion? Your listeners should just get their minds around that $421 billion in 8 years, what they could have done with that money, investing it in clean technology, in all kinds of other pursuits. Well, one of the things they could have done that was recommended to them back in 2010 is they could have built their own fab. It might have cost them a third of that amount to build a state-of-the-art fab, or most a half of it over that period of time. Now, why is TSMC the world leader? This is the Taiwanese company that is now really way ahead of everybody else in terms of semiconductor technology. Well, Apple's 25% of their revenues, and they grew as Apple grew and outsourced their semiconductor manufacturing to them. Actually, they used Samsung first and TSMC from 2015. Okay, so the point of this is that if you're going to, the Biden administration and Congress should not be supporting the U.S. semiconductor industry unless it stops wasting its money, manipulating its stock price. And now I know that Joe Biden was very critical of stock buybacks. Back in 2015, he was talking about this. And in 2016, he had an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal, which criticized it. In fact, named my research as kind of the inspiration for the criticism. A funny thing happened along the way, which is very strange, is that I went back to look at the article online, and it said, according to economist William Lozonik, so much had been spent on buybacks over this period of time. Someone went in and cut out my name, so I guess they don't want to be too associated with buybacks at this point. And that's a real problem, because right now, although Biden himself, this has always been a big issue for him. He talked about this banning buybacks a year ago last March during the campaign, of course, when the pandemic was going on. That's not being talked about at all. Now, if you go back and you say the issue not just of are the corporations really going to do their part? And that's my point. The corporations are going to get all this spending that they're going to be able to make use of, but they're not going to do their part. And if they don't do their part, the jobs won't get created. You won't have global competitiveness. I can go in a variety of other industries. But the other side of it is, of course, who's going to pay for it? Now, it was quite well known when the tax rate came down for corporations from 35% to 21% in December of 2017 on both sides that that money would be used for, by companies to buy back their own stock. And in fact, many companies at low interest rate borrowed money to buy back their stock after the tax cut. They also were able to more cheaply repatriate profits. They got a tax rate on that, and they used that for buybacks. And in fact, among senators led by Schumer, Democratic senators, I think there were about 25 of them that signed on to what was called hashtag GOP tax scam. It was all about the companies using the tax cuts to do stock buybacks. Now, I'm not hearing that now. I mean, so when they're talking about going back halfway back to 28%, and is this going to be a burden on companies? All the Democrats need to be saying right now is they got those cuts, and those cuts were just used to boost their stock price, to make the rich richer, to make the hedge fund activists happier, to make the executives richer. And they're not talking about those issues. So that's what I'd like to hear about at this point. And that's kind of because there's two parties here. Well, there's three parties, really. There are households who need all the support to be able to be productive. We saw that during the pandemic, the weakness of the U.S. economy there. There's the government that needs to be spending money on physical infrastructure, human capabilities. That's always been the case, and that continues to be the case. But the big part of it is business. Business is over 80% of employment in the U.S. economy, and it's particular businesses that are dominating or can dominate or dominate in their industries, and we can depend upon for global competition, Intel being one of them. And if they're not doing the spending to complement this infrastructure spending, then we're not going to get the jobs. We're not going. It's not going to be successful. It will be more taxpayer money from households like me and you and others going to these companies, which are just going to then use it to just get their stock price up. So something has to be done about that.
And again, I'm speaking with William Zonick, who's a professor emeritus of economics and the former director of the University of Massachusetts Center for Industrial Competitiveness. He's the president of the Academic Industry Research Network, and his books include Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy, Business Organizations and High-Tech Employment in the United States, and Predatory Value Extraction, How the Looting of the Business Corporation Became the U.S. Norm and How Sustainable Prosperity Can Be Restored. So having made the case that private industry in the United States, big corporations, are not investing in the future, they're investing in buying back stocks and driving up the price and taking care of their shareholders and their executives, let's turn to government investment, which is what we're talking about in terms of what Biden announced with this bipartisan deal that he struck with Republican senators and Democratic senators. Does it invest in the future?
Well, it's necessary, absolutely necessary. And, I saw Biden today give his speech and, talking about the interstate highway system and, investment in railroads. And that's true enough. But particularly when you had investment in the interstate highway system, you had a totally different stance on the part of business in terms of investment in the economy. I mean, back then, if you got a job with, General Motors, you had a job for life. And, as the former CEO of General Motors had said when he became defense secretary, what's good for General Motors is good for the United States and vice versa. Well, that actually was true, even though the Democrats criticized it back then. Companies were making those investments in their own internal capability. They were using their profits, which is the foundation for them to invest in the future, to invest in new products, new processes. New competition came on the scene, to be sure, with the coming of the Japanese, and that in many ways influenced U.S. companies to shift away from that investment, become more financialized. And, what I'm talking about is something that actually has been going on to a large extent with these companies since the 1980s. But the fact is that, yes, we need all that government investment. We need as much as Biden has put into that infrastructure bill. They're right, it's not stimulus, which is it's often called. This is investment in the future, which is a very different thing. Some is not just something that stimulates the economy. It might have that impact, but that's not the real issue now. Is we need that infrastructure, and we need the other side of it is the investment in human capabilities, because that's what makes that infrastructure work. But ultimately, it's companies that make use of all those communication systems, energy systems, transportation systems, etc. And they're the ones who have to have the highly developed labor force available in order to be able to compete abroad. Now, there we've gotten in many ways in the United States off the hook, because basically we've been able to, particularly since the Immigration Act of 1990, but really since the 1980s, been able to tap into highly educated Asian labor that has worked in the United States, either on come in on preferred employment preferences, on L-1 visas, on H-1B visas. And we have a huge advantage in the United States in terms of the, insofar as particularly the tech industry compete by having access to that labor. But in the process, kind of business said, okay, we don't need to worry about things that Biden's talking about now. We don't need to worry about educating the labor force in the United States to be ready for, you know, the new technology world, the world of clean environment, of now, of course, dealing with things like pandemics. They said, we just got to get our stock price up. And so this is something actually has been going on since the mid-1980s. I've been criticizing them since then, but it's gotten way worse over the last 10 years. It was bad enough coming into the financial crisis, but it's gotten much worse since then. And basically, Congress right now, in trying to get this stuff through, is just not dealing with that set of issues. And however much spending is done by the government is not going to do the job if the entities that provide over 80% of employment in the United States and are critical to getting those products to market don't do their job. And, you know, I saw a statement by Biden's security advisor, Brian Deese, gave a day or two yesterday, perhaps, about how, you know, he concluded, we believe in American capitalism and we're going to make American capitalism work. Well, American capitalism, I'm afraid, is not working right now. It's not working for most people. And that's not because of lack of government spending. It's because of the way businesses are acting. So, yeah, I'm all for the government spending, but the other side of it has to be taken care of.
So, but in terms of the investments that are in this package, for example, investing in the future, electrical vehicle investment, it's only $7.5 billion to build a network of chargers. And also $7.5 billion towards making thousands of school and transit buses electric. But it's not really about electrifying transportation and building a clean grid for the future to deal with climate change. So everybody seems to think that, in fact, Senator Blumenthal referred to this package as being pathetic, that the real stuff is going to have to be done through reconciliation. And Bernie Sanders is talking about $6.5 trillion. So what do you see going on there?
It's going to take a lot. But again, you can't do it without business. You know, I mean, okay, the amount spent by just S&P 500 companies on stock buybacks over the last 10 years is 5.3 or 5.4 trillion. You know, it's huge amount. And it's really highly concentrated among the companies that have the capabilities to make these kind of investments. And basically, a lot of those technologies are being developed in other countries. China is moving ahead very rapidly, these technologies. Europe is developing these technologies alone. So the United States is not there. Now, you need the government spending. I totally agree with that. And but it really needs to be part of coordinated government-business partnerships that really get the commitment of business to make this investment. And when the government makes investment, and that's the part of it they're not taking care of at this point. And of course, if business doesn't buy in, since they are big donors, et cetera, you're not going to get Sanders' spending. If Bezos bought in, you could start getting all kinds of spending. If people running U.S. corporations were really dedicated to building their companies, keeping people employed, building their capabilities, becoming leaders in international competition. And they've done this before, and there are some companies that are doing it now, including in electric vehicles. But if they were really committed to that, they would be out front in saying, yeah, let's get the spending. Now, what is happening is that they are lobbying for the spending, but they're not out front in terms of it, and they're not willing to pay the taxes to support it. And they can afford to pay the taxes because they have all that money that is just going to boost their stock prices. Now, if that's more important to Americans, boosting stock prices, and only a small proportion of Americans really have significant stock, well, that's the way it's going to go, but you're going to get more inequality, and that doesn't create a competitive industry in the future. The foundation of competitive industry, whatever the government spends, is the companies that have those capabilities, that build those capabilities over time, a company like Apple, or like Intel, like Cisco, investing, taking that money and building on those capabilities, investing for the future. And they've stopped doing that. And I mean, I can name many other companies that are doing the same thing. And so that you have to deal with the whole package. And the whole package is not just what Biden's going to do trying to get through Congress. The whole package has to do with business being able and willing to carry out the kinds of investments on its own that complement and that build on the investment that we're funding as taxpayers, and being willing to pay their share to support these investments. And again, when the tax cuts were done, which pure gift to rich people, basically everybody understood that in December 2017, the Democrats were right out there talking about the problem of business and just going to use all this money to do stock buybacks. Why aren't they talking about that now? My suspicion is that there are certain donors and certain entities supporting the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party who don't want them to talk about these issues. And many of the advisors that Biden has around them are, even though they're aware of these issues, I know many of them are, they're not talking about them. So I want these issues of corporate financialization to be brought into the discussion. And then it can be, you can talk about what is the need of particular industries and how much investment has to be made. There is a lot of investment going on. As a lot of it's highly speculative money that's been going into electric batteries and electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles, et cetera. So it's not like there isn't spending going on there, but it's actually more likely to be done in a coordinated way, in particularly in China, to some extent in Europe, than it is in the United States. So we might end up spending a lot of money, and a lot of the technology we spend money from coming out of the government, as has happened in the past, might just end up going somewhere else around the world where it gets used much better than in the United States in terms of developing the technologies, creating leading companies. So the business side of this has to be taken into account, and I don't see that discussion going on.
Well, William Lasonic, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot. And again, I've been speaking with William Lasonic, who's a professor emeritus of economics and a former director of the University of Massachusetts Center for Industrial Competitiveness. He is president of the Academic Industry Research Network, and his books include Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy, Business Organizations and High-Tech Employment in the United States, and Predatory Value Extraction, How the Looting of the Business Corporation Became the U.S. Norm and How Sustainable Prosperity Can Be Restored. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America.